If you'd like to know more about the plants mentioned on this episode, visit our Instagram page at Plants People Places Podcast or our Facebook page and just search for Plants People and Places Podcast. Welcome to Plants, People and Places, the podcast in which we speak with plants people and find out what special connection they have with their plants. In this episode, we speak with author and plant developer Kevin Hobbs. Kevin, welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Philip. Good to be here.
How are you?
Yeah, very good. Thank you. Hectic as ever, but good.
Yeah. I've described you as author and plant developer, but can you tell us a bit about yourself, please?
Yeah, no problem at all. Well, yeah, from the beginning, I was briefly, I was a Hillier apprentice, and obviously was lucky enough to be an apprentice at the nursery that's founded in 1864, one of the oldest and longest established nurseries in the UK, and even better, right next to what was then the Hillier Arboretum, which is nowadays the Sir Harold Hillier Gardens. So that's where I started off, and I did leave Hillier actually shortly after my apprenticeship to join my old friend David West, who had also worked at Hillier as he was in charge of the seed department at Hillier, and he wanted to set up his own business. He'd come into some money and land, and wanted to set up Fromfield Nursery, and I joined him as his first and only employee at that point. But we did grow the business, and it was great fun because we were growing rare and unusual plants from seed, and our plants were going out all over the world indeed. So that was fun. And then from there, I went to a nursery called Rich Alps Nursery near Guildford. So obviously, having started at Hillier and Fromfield in the Romsey area, not far from Winchester, went to a nursery in Guildford called Rich Alps Nursery. And as the name implies, primarily an alpine nursery, although we did start to introduce a lot of herbaceous perennials to the range, and of course there were some woody plants, but they're typically dwarf alpine like woody plants, and we supplied garden centers with such plants. And then I came back to Hillier as production manager, and ultimately became wholesale nursery director at Hillier. And was in charge of all the production, which is a big job, as you can well imagine.
Yeah, I bet.
and from Hillier, I left Hillier in the end of 2018, and I joined my current employer, and I've been made director, and we're called Pinnacle Plants International, and we have got lots of business interests, but we primarily tissue culture production. So we have a tissue culture in vitro propagation in China, and one that we just set up in Mexico 2 or 3 years ago.
Wow.
And as well as initiating new plants into tissue culture in the UK, of course. So our tissue culture plants, our young plants, are sold all around the world, but the big market is North America, there's no doubt. And that ranges from, what we might consider hardy garden plants to here in the UK, we consider house plants. But of course, customers in Florida, they're outdoor plants, for example.
Yeah, so, very jealous.
So we grow a wide range of plants. We've also got a partner nursery in the Cape of South Africa. So we grow, again, a really wide range of interesting plants, South African plants. And again, because we've got customers in warmer climes, whether it's the south of France or Italy, or the South African range works very nicely. But there's plenty, as you know, that we can grow here in the UK, because you've had some of the plants from our South African nursery.
I definitely grow some. Yeah, we've got some in the moat at Walmer Castle as well, which is doing really well. So loving the range that you usually have. So very, very good. Yeah, thanks
excellent.
For that.
Yeah, anyway, mustn't forget Wetman Pinks is part of our business, the Dianthus nursery down in Dawlish in Devon.
Oh, yes.
Where they breed the Dianthus. And they also go all around the world, and I'm sure, and of course, my colleague and friend, I should say, my friend, and who became my colleague, Charles Valan, who was the breeder at Thompson and Morgan, joined the company at the same time as me in January 2019, and Charles is in Ipswich breeding, so
Oh,
we're
wow.
working on lots of different breeding projects,
Oh, it sounds like
and.
quite a range.
And of course, and then of course we represent breeders and anyone who's breeding plants or might discover a new plant, a spore, or a mutation that's got potential in the marketplace. We represent such plants around the world and take care of all the IP and protections and so on. So and then finally we contract grow we contract grow finished plants for wholesale nurseries. So we grow 350,000 lavenders in 2 liter, for example, and we also grow a huge range of trees and shrubs, and many of those actually go to crocus and the RHS and so on and so forth.
Okay. Well, you do sound like the perfect candidate for this podcast by the sounds of that, with all those different ranges of plants you grow. So, but you mentioned that you started as a trainee at Hilliers. So, but what originally got you into horticulture and being obsessed with plants then?
So, somewhat of a familiar story, I'm sure, for yourself and many of your listeners. Really, my granddad. We started off in a council house as a family, but my grandparents still lived on a small holding with a few acres of land, and of course, that was a dream to explore that and climb the trees. And my most vivid memory really is climbing up a peduncular oak, Quercus robur, and exploring the branches and observing the finer detail of the tree and all the biodiversity, of course, that oak trees support. And in fact, my grandparents had, they were abandoned, but old pig pens that they used for composting. And I remember rummaging around in the compost, which was predominantly oak leaves, because there's so many Quercus robur and Petraea locally. I was rummaging around in the compost bins, and I remember digging around and finding these alien-like strands, which, of course, I now know, or since found out, that they're mycorrhiza. And so I was fascinated by this, by these strands of hyphae and the fungi and the life, basically all the life that the oak tree was supporting, living and dead, of course, once the leaves were composting, they were still supporting life. So it's saprophytic fungi growing in the compost bin. So basically that set me off on a path, having been written off at school. I was determined. I knew what I wanted to do. I loved plants. I was hungry to learn. I'm still hungry to learn. We never stop learning. I've been doing it for almost 40 years now, and we all learn from each other. And one thing you and I have talked about in the past, I really do not like the fact that some people within horticulture talk about amateurs and professionals. To me, there's passion for plants, and I know plenty of people that don't work in horticulture, don't make a living from horticulture, but they're very knowledgeable and expert on their chosen subjects. Of course, we've got plenty of colleagues in plant heritage that are examples of that, and such as yourself, although you do work in horticulture, of course. So.
Well, you mentioned that that oak tree, and I think trees are quite important in your life because I think you wrote a book about trees as well, didn't you?
Yes, over the years I contributed, and I still do contribute, to the Hillier Manual of Trees and Shrubs, which some of your listeners may be familiar with. I used to do it on behalf of John Hillier when I was working at Hillier. And for the most recent edition, I was actually acknowledged for my participation, which was nice. And we're working on the next one. So that's very much a reference manual. Many people call it the horticultural Bible. It's always amusing, actually, when I travel. I've been to Japan, where and met nurserymen that don't speak English, and I don't speak Japanese or not very much, and they'll come out clutching the Helio Manual of Trees and Shrubs, which is always nice to see. And I've seen, see it all around the world. And I got to the point where I felt, wouldn't it be nice to expand on the information in such a book? I approached a publisher, and I was lucky enough to get commissioned to write The Story of Trees. And somewhat daunted by the enormity of the task with a full-time job, commercial horticulture is not a 9-to-5 job, or horticulture generally is not a 9-to-5 job for many of us. I asked my friend, David West, and so we wrote about 100 trees, and we wrote 50 each, and I wrote the introduction, and it was a real pleasure. And we are very proud of it, and it's done very well. It's in a number of different languages.
Brilliant.
It's most recently come out in China, in fact, but it's also in Korean and Italian and German and Spanish. So that was great fun, and that gave us the opportunity to literally write the story of trees. So we chose 100 subjects, and it was about humankind's interaction with those subjects, as far as archaeological records go, and then of course written history, which goes back about 400,000 years thereabouts.
Yeah, no, I've got it, and it is an absolutely amazing book. And I'm really glad that our Korean listeners will also be able to buy it
Yeah, exactly.
now. So, I do always ask people, they quite often struggle with it, but what is your favorite plant?
Well, I can understand why people struggle, but I have got very much a go-to favorite plant, not surprisingly, because I guess over the years, I've always wanted to know the background to the trees and plants that I grow as a grower or grow in my garden. And of course, and it features in the title of your podcast, Plants, People, Places. So it's good to know exactly all the detail of as much detail as you can find behind the plants you grow. And I think my favorite's got to be Ginkgo biloba.
Oh, wow, yeah.
It's probably the choice of many people, but wow, what a tree, essentially unchanged for 200 million years. Very much a living fossil, endangered in the wild in Zhejiang Province, China. But of course, it's far from endangered because it's a beloved tree that has been propagated and grown, far and wide, in temperate climates especially. It's just so many fascinating stories and facts behind the surrounding ginkgo. It survived all the glacial periods. Many of the lineages of the branches of ginkgo died off to leave the one we have today. But it's a survivor, survived in China. And I could talk for an hour on ginkgo, of course, but I won't. But it's got motile sperm. That's a fascinating fact. So I love the fact you've obviously got male and female trees, and in spring the pollen from the male trees, which is windborne, fills the air, and in the hope of finding a female. And the female is such an ancient tree. It's very unique because it doesn't really have a flower, female flower as such. It's just a essentially an ovary, and at the end of the tip of the ovary is fluid that protrudes from the tip of the ovary, and that catches the pollen as it flies through the air, and then it's withdrawn into the ovary. And from then, this is a spring still. The pollen grain produces a pair of sperm, and they begin to form, and then in autumn, around September time, the sperm swim to the egg, which of course is within the future seed, and pollinates the egg and produces a seed. So to have motile sperm, is obviously fascinating, and an evolutionary experiment, that and plants plants that are long extinct shared a similar process, but are few and far between nowadays to have that method of pollination. And the trees tend to be 25 to 30 years old before they set fruit. Have you ever tasted ginkgo fruit, Philip?
No, I haven't actually. There was one in Canterbury that had lots and lots of fruit on it, but I have to admit the smell sort of put me off when you walked around it.
Exactly. Well, that's, yeah, for any listeners that might not be familiar, the fruit, which of course is on the female tree, they look like kind of buff, yellowy, buffy, beige olives almost in clusters.
Yeah, or like a yellow plum as well.
And they look fantastic on the tree, but when they fall, they famously smell of vomit is the most common. They are very, very putrid smelling, and that's quite amusing in itself, actually, because when predominantly the West, of course, the tree originates in China, and the Japanese were growing it, shortly after. But the West, when the Westerners latched onto ginkgo, this amazing living fossil, there was a rush to plant ginkgo trees, and there's already a recognition that it's better to plant male trees, especially in a street situation. But inevitably, there are mistakes. Trees raised from seed and planted before they had actually started to bear pollen or fruit. So you do on occasions get male and female trees in close proximity. And I remember in New York City visiting to see some female trees, and the putrid smelling fruit surrounding them was being trodden into the high-end boutique shops,
Nice.
which I wasn't shopping in, because I'm too rough and ready to shop in such shops, and I have never had the money to do so. But it did amuse me, because the shop owners, and indeed their clientele, were and are dismayed to have these smelly fruits disrupting their business and shopping. And in fact, they did petition to get some cut down, but quite
Oh,
rightly
really?
were refused. But luckily, the expat Chinese community and Japanese community, no doubt, and Korean and East Asian communities in New York, and indeed any other cities where there might be a female tree, quite often go and hoover up the fruit, because you can actually eat the fruit, but it's the kernel that's most commonly eaten. And in over the years, I've traveled to Japan and worked in Japan, and I remember my first time of eating ginkgo kernels. They're served as a bar snack,
All right.
and my friend Taka Kobayashi said that they nullify the effects of alcohol if you eat them,
And did
and
it
I can tell you it does not work.
A shame.
Too much sake, and followed up by whiskey, and they did not work. But typically in Japan, there's occasionally very interesting foods to eat, like puffer fish, of course, which I ate without realizing. I probably would have eaten it anyway, but I was unwittingly ate it before someone pointed out it was puffer fish. Fugu, but the ginkgo kernel, if you eat too many of them, they are actually toxic. So,
Oh, really?
unlike almonds, where you'd need to eat buckets to be poisoned, you don't need to eat so many ginkgo nuts to be made sick. But luckily, I never got poorly on it. But it's an amazing tree. And then, of course, there's a chichi. Have you heard of the chichi?
No, I haven't. What's that?
Well, ginkgo, mature ginkgo, and there's many people that claim ginkgo that are 5,000, 6,000 years old, but the oldest recorded tree was 3,200, from memory, years old. And there's likely to be older trees, of course. And nowadays, with modern techniques to carbon dating and so on, you can check that. But basically, on older trees, typically around 1,000 years old, or coming up to 1,000 years old, they can form chichi, which are like stalactites, essentially hanging from the branch.
Oh
So
yes, yeah.
you get these yeah, it's best to describe them almost like stalactite like structures hanging from the branches. And it's an evolutionary mechanism that ultimately allows the these chichi to hit the ground and produce essentially clonal plants and support the older main tree that they were born on.
Wow.
And you see it in China and Japan, especially China. You see some of these very, very long established chichi. But it's very curious. I can't think of any, or certainly no prominent chichi on trees in the UK, but occasionally outside of East Asia, you do see them, but they're not normally as impressive.
Wow.
And then what about the atomic bomb? I'm sure you know about the story of the atomic bomb
Oh
in
yeah,
the
wasn't the
UK.
ginkgo the only thing that survived?
That's right. So the Japanese already considered ginkgo as the bearer of hope, and many people think it's attributed to the fact it survived the atomic bomb, which is a very good reason for calling it the bearer of hope. But actually, they already held it in high regard because in 1923 there was an earthquake, a massive earthquake in the Kanto region of Japan, and it caused lots of fires, and whole cities and towns burnt, and ginkgos burnt along with them, only to reshoot and regrow after the great Kanto earthquake and fire. But then, just over 20 years later, of course, August 1945, the atomic bomb was dropped, and the damage was surveyed, a month or two after, and people were amazed to see that ginkgo, around 1,000 meters from the epicenter, were actually starting to shoot,
Wow, yeah.
and from charred stems. So very good reason for calling the ginkgo the bearer of hope.
Yeah,
So there you
literally
go.
bomb-proof then.
Exactly, and there you go. That's why it's my favorite tree, that it represents. I'm really interested in living fossils, Metascoria glyptostroboides. Of
And
course,
that's
there's
why we're
a
friends, aren't we, Kevin?
yeah, exactly. Well, I can't say that of you because I've got at least 10 years on you, so you can say it of me. But yeah, so hopefully that was succinct enough. But that's why I love ginkgo.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely brilliant, and it's really nice as well because quite often people sort of I could do that, and it depends on the time of year. And I personally have that as well. It's like every week, if you would ask me, there's probably a different plant that is my favorite. But yeah, you definitely have a very definite favorite, haven't you? So that's brilliant. On the other hand, as well, we talk about plant icks. So are there any plants that you hate and that you would just never want to grow in your garden?
Well, this is more difficult, really, because I love plants. And what I've learned, so in answer to your question, I would say highly bred bedding plants is an ick for me. But I qualify that by saying, when you get down into the species, every plant's fascinating, and these highly bred bedding plants have come from species, of course, and very old cultivars and that hit me, I think, in what was it, 1998, I believe it was, when I was in the Drakensberg Mountains,
Oh,
or
wow.
Drakensberg. I get told off by South African friends. Drakensberg Mountains,
Drakensberg.
KwaZulu-Natal. And I was obviously plant exploring, taking nothing but pictures, I might add. I am a plant explorer, but I generally exploring nurseries around the world rather than the wild. But I do go into the wild, of course I do. And I noticed Gazania linearis, and Gazania I wouldn't have paid much attention to prior to that point as a bed, as the aforementioned bedding. But when you see such plants in the wild, and you see the species, and you see where they've come from, it brings a new admiration to the bedding plants. But for me, obviously, I like perennials in my garden. It's not very sustainable and environmentally friendly to have lots and lots of bedding. And we, as we all know, there's been a big move away from bedding plants in recent years. And but there's still ways of using them and enjoying them as well, of course. So yeah, if I had to, I couldn't really nail it down to one plant, but yeah, highly bred bedding plants would be my ick, as you say.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention that about species, because I can't remember the name, but there is a petunia species that's quite popular as well. It's a really lovely little red flower. I'll look that up, and yeah, that's a lovely thing. And you wouldn't think that was the same as like the petunias that you would normally buy in a garden centre as your bedding plant. And yeah, no, definitely something to say for the species as well.
Exactly. And yeah, with my friend and colleague Charles Valland, when it comes to breeding, we favor making really innovative crosses, and avoiding, you know, just more busy Lizzies, you know, intergeneric hybrids and interspecific hybrids, and looking at the phylogeny and of how plants are related, and then with our worldwide network, you know, getting the genetics, the plants, from different locations and countries, and, you know, bringing species from different continents together. They might flower at a different time of year. We, you know, freeze the pollen, go to great lengths to do something really different and new, you know, because you know, Charles is a very talented breeder, and he could have easily gone and worked for some of the big companies that breed, you know, busy Lizzies and pelargoniums and so on. But, you know, we agreed it's much more fun to do something really different, and obviously most of which is secret, because I can't tell
We
you what
might
the
see
work
them in the
is.
next few years.
Exactly.
No, brilliant. If you look at like plants that you've recently, well, maybe discovered, but that could be in nurseries or plant fairs. I know you went to the French plant fair as well as Saint-Jean de Beauregard. Do you have any plants like that you think more people should grow, like that you've recently come across?
Well, a really interesting one, that when you and I went to Saint-Jean de Beauregard, a plant that Philippe Bonduel, a dear friend, an amazing plantsman in France and horticultural journalist, picked up for us, kindly picked up for us, is Abatia angeliniana. And that's a fascinating plant. I just put it on Instagram recently. I'm on Instagram as at Flora Fanatica. It's the only social media I do. It's all plants. But this Abatia is fascinating because it's Salicaceae, Salix willow family, and it's got these kind of spikes, almost like Veronica spikes, you know, candle-like spikes
Oh,
of
yeah.
flowers. That are really bright yellow, but it's a very showy flower for that family, and it's been known to survive -8 in France in a freeze-raining soil. It comes from Argentina. It's in Argentina, so my friend in Argentina knew it, and but it goes as far as to south and southeast Brazil. And that's something special. So yeah, I popped that on Instagram recently. When I was in Hawaii on honeymoon, back in, when was it, the early March, end of February, early March, I was fascinated by the Hawaiian flora. I mean, just like many of your listeners, of course, us plant nerds, we're always looking out. We're sat in a traffic jam looking at the verge and seeing what we can see. And of course, you put me anywhere in the world, maybe not in the Sahara Desert, that's and I'll find plants to look at. But in Hawaii, there's such a diversity, and one of the endemics there is Metrosideros polymorpha, Myrtaceae, and that was absolutely fascinating because we were visiting the Hawaii Volcano National Park, and it was growing near the steam vents, and right next to the sulfur, the really nasty sulfur, which obviously you have to be careful when visiting, not to breathe too much of it in. And I thought that, well, that's incredible that they can colonize the old lava flows and also be near, very close to active lava, or at least in the case of March, the vents and the sulfur. And I looked it up, and of course, it's evolved the ability to close its stomata
Oh, wow.
when downwind of any of these toxic fumes. So, isn't the plant world amazing?
Yeah, oh, definitely. You wouldn't think that anything would grow there even.
So yes, and there's plenty of other new plants, of course, besides that. So, in fact, I included Zoster marina, the marine grass or seagrass, in edible the book, because it produces an edible grain,
Wow.
not dissimilar to quinoa, but with a kind of obviously salty taste. And but that's a fascinating plant because it's a flowering plant that lives about a meter down in coastal waters and of the northern hemisphere. And so there's no end of amazing plants to discuss, and
No.
I could go on all day if you wish.
Well, I think we might need to get you back at some point for another half an hour of this podcast, and we can discuss some more plants that you've come across and seen. But it's been really, really good to talk to you, Kevin. And for anyone who wants to know more about these plants, do look us up on Instagram, Plants People Places Podcast, or of course go on Kevin's Instagram as well, which is at Flora Fanatica, and we'll try and get pictures up of the plants that were discussed today. Thanks again, Kevin, for all of this, and we'll speak soon.
Thank you, Philip. Thanks for having me.